Today's episode of Locked On Heat is brought to you by SeatGeek, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets. Use the promo code LOHEAT, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. You can email us your mailbag questions for when we do our Mailbag Mondays, and if you're interested in advertising on the show, send us an email. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. Now, on with the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm the editor at AllYouCanHeat.com, and with me on the other line, he's a man of many bylines. It's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. Feels like it's been a while since it's just been you and I talking Heat basketball, but as always, looking forward to it.
Yeah, we've had other people dropping in our conversations, wanting to talk about their basketball teams, like, all week.
How unfair of them.
So, speaking of that, we are going to talk with Brad Rowland of Locked On Hawks. And by we, I mean David. And his conversation with Brad is going to be coming up after this. But we did need to dig in a little bit on the latest regarding Chris Bosh, who, in a podcast for Bleacher Report's Uninterrupted, said, and this is a quote, "I'm ready to play. We've been talking about it for a long time. We released a statement back in May saying as soon as I'm ready to play and as soon as possible, we'll play. And I'm ready. I've done all the work. I've done what I need to do with the doctors. I am in incredible shape, at least decent enough. I look good when I take my shirt off, especially with Mickey Arison saying, see you at camp. I think it's moving forward. I have no reason to believe that it's not. And we'll finish this." And that's kind of the key part, "and we'll finish this" towards the end. So, talking a lot about, you know, a sort of short recap of what this whole summer has been as far as working with doctors and working out and getting into playing shape again since he's not been, you know, playing basketball for so long. And then finally saying at the end, "we'll finish this," very, very optimistic viewpoint from Chris Bosh, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like the finish line is finally in sight and we might get some kind of resolution. But the missing piece, unfortunately, as it has been ever since the diagnosis first came up at some point during the season last year, was, you know, the Miami Heat have yet to officially say anything, and I don't think that they will. I mean, we've gotten some comments from Pat Riley. We've got a tweet from Mickey Arison, and although we don't think that's nearly enough to clear Chris Bosh, we're still missing something much more official. But I think, as we've talked about before, this does give fans cause for optimism because he does seem ready and willing to move forward and to be an active part of this season. So I think we've seen the workout videos. It looks like he's driving to the hoop. He's pulling up for jumpers. He's doing what Chris Bosh has always done throughout his career. So I think it's a good sign. I'm not sure how to feel about it. I know some people we've talked to felt that maybe he should retire. You know, and I think that seems to be a prevailing thought amongst the Heat fan base. Where do you stand on this?
I mean, I want him to play. I think you mentioned how in the videos he's driving to the hoop, he's taking jumpers, he's looking good. That's never been really the issue. I think the issue is, I mean, I understand trying to get back into playing shape and working out for the season, that's encouraging. And just seeing him play basketball is encouraging if you're a Heat fan. But it's the contact, and that's the issue, is getting hit and suffering some sort of injury or another clot, God forbid, something life-threatening, you know? And that's always been the issue, but it's been a few days now since the Miami Herald's Barry Jackson reported that both sides expect Bosh, or at least Bosh expects, to be medically cleared within the next few weeks. And that's what he said, the next few weeks. And it's been a few days since that report. And since then, we haven't really heard anything combating that or going against it from either the Heat organization or Mickey Arison by himself or Pat Riley on his own. We've not really heard, or just some sort of report, anything from an anonymous source saying anything of the contrary. So to me, that's encouraging. Maybe they really are working towards something here. You know, overall, I don't want him to retire, but I do want him to be safe. And that's why I keep thinking, I don't expect Bosh to come back and just play 82 games. I think, as we talked about on our podcast with Sean Hyken, that came out Thursday morning, I do think it's going to be a maintenance program of sorts where he's probably not playing in the second game of back-to-backs, might not be even involved in 3 or 4 game road trips, which the Heat have a handful of this upcoming season. So maybe he plays something around 50 to 65 games or something like that. But that's way better than just playing the first 40 and then not seeing him, you know, including any potential playoff bid.
Well, there is some cause for pessimism, all those things aside. And I don't know how if you got to a chance to read this particular quote, but he goes on in the discussion, I guess, or what Barry Jackson reported from the uninterrupted podcast. He says that he has full confidence that he'll be there at camp, but then he follows it up by asking the question, will I be cleared? I don't know, but that's out of my hands, but I will play basketball in the NBA. I'm confident. It seems to continue to drive that point that there might be some kind of division between Bosch, his camp, which includes his wife, his agent, et cetera, and the team. The front office has clearly been mum about it. So I'm wondering whether or not there is going to be some lingering resentment there between Bosch and the front office. You know, I mean, clearly his first priority is to get back out there and play. He feels he's healthy. He feels he's got whatever he needs to go out there and play. But he's lacking clearance from the team, and he seems confident that he'll get it. But at the same time, he follows that up by saying, well, I don't know. It's out of my hands. And that he'll play basketball in the NBA. It's like, well, you're not going to play basketball in the NBA without that clearance, buddy. I mean, it's unless he's threatening the potential of getting the players union involved.
That's what it seems like to me, right? It's like one way or another, I'm playing in the NBA. And it's going to be for the Heat, or it's going to be for maybe one of these other 29 teams. That's, to me, what that sounds like.
Yeah, it sure does.
You know, I think his frustration must be from a lack of communication, and this team, this organization, this Heat front office has had a bad habit maybe of, or at least a reputation lately, of not communicating with its star players. And I think, you know, we've talked about a number of times on this podcast about us not knowing what the hell's really going on with Bosch and not having any word. Maybe it's a tweet with a basketball emoji. Maybe it's a offhand comment in a team video by Eric Spoelstra or something, but nothing really about fully 100% about Chris Bosch, nothing concrete about Chris Bosch. And, you know, he must be getting a lot of that too. I mean, I doubt that Pat Riley is texting him on a weekly basis. I mean, maybe he is, but from the sounds of it, he's not. Like, saying, hang in there, buddy, we're going to get this figured out or something like that. And maybe from the Heat standpoint, they can't do that for whatever medical, legal, you know, reasons, but if you're Chris Bosch and you just want to play basketball or at least want to know, you know, like maybe that might be the hard, like if you guys aren't medically going to clear me, let me know now. Don't keep me on this string, right?
Right. Or explore a trade or look to move me or do something. But, you know, just don't keep me in the dark. And unfortunately, this is probably a discussion for another podcast. And it's, you know, as Heat fans, as longtime people who followed the team for a while, you know, we've come to accept that the team has this reputation of having a close-knit family and all this, but it seems like there's growing concern, at least on my end, that there might be some kind of clear lack of communication up there. And I'm not sure if it's just that Riley's a little far removed from the situation. Maybe he feels burnt by LeBron, but clearly there's a lot at stake here because, I mean, you know, his relationship with LeBron deteriorated so quickly. And then it seems like Wade, almost by extension, wound up mistrusting the organization and not having that full, they didn't share the same vision, the same plan as how to move forward. Now Chris Bosch is the third of the big three, and he's clearly going through some issues as well. And so you look at, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, a guy like Udonis Haslem, who's been with the organization for so long and wants to continue being there. Last season, when Goran Dragic re-signed with the team, he said it was all about loyalty for him, and maybe that was just a dig at Robert Sarver and the Phoenix Suns, but he felt like he was getting a culture here that he could be a part of moving forward. And I'm not sure where to stand on this because, I mean, again, you want to believe that the Heat has their players' best interests at heart, but what we're seeing is maybe, you know, little bits and pieces here that they're not necessarily communicating as well as they ought to.
All right, well, we're going to keep our finger on the pulse of this as we continue along this Chris Bosch storyline. Every time something comes up, we're going to try to talk about it on this podcast. But for now, we got to take a break. We want to talk about SeatGeek. Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process for a long time. It's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show that you want to go to. And none of those older ticket sites want to change that. But SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. Everything about SeatGeek is designed to make life easier for the sports and music fan. SeatGeek does all the price comparison for you by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring that you get the best possible deal. SeatGeek does all of that work, and you save time and money. The SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Best of all, our listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek ticket purchase. To get your $20 rebate, download the SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab, and click Add a Promo Code. Enter the promo code LOHEAT, L-O-H-E-A-T, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your very first ticket purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LOHEAT today. So with that, we're going to get into David's conversation with Brad Rowland of Locked On Hawks as we continue along our crossover podcast series. And yeah, let's just get into it.
What's up, everybody? This is a crossover episode of the Locked On Hawks podcast, and joining me today is David Ramil of the Locked On Heat podcast. What's up, man?
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm enjoying these crossover episodes. Personally, on my feed, I've not done one in a couple of days. I know you guys have been busy on yours, and we just like to have fun, talk some relevant basketball. And obviously, the Hawks and the Heat have a lot in common. They play in the same division, sort of been not diehard rivals, but certainly teams that see each other quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there hasn't really been a rivalry. I'm not sure that the Heat have a rivalry at this point. I'm not sure that the Hawks do either. But yeah, it's always interesting matchups whenever Miami faces Atlanta.
Yeah, for sure. I think if I had to pick a Hawks rival, it'd probably be the Celtics because of just, that's more of like a 20 years ago rivalry than anything else. So I think you're right. I don't think the Hawks have a rival. You know, most NBA teams don't have rivals when you think about it, at least not like in the way that you would think of other some other professional or especially college sports where there's that obvious foil. But, you know, the Hawks and the Heat have a lot of stuff going on, and we can talk about both teams today.
Yeah, that sounds good. I know that the Hawks have gone through some turmoil, but certainly Miami has as well.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to ask you, you know, there's obviously a lot to talk about for both teams, but, you know, I think the biggest story, as much as the Hawks are interesting and has some change, I think the biggest story between the two teams, I think the two biggest stories really probably both reside in Miami, and, you know, between Dwayne Wade leaving town and the Chris Bosh situation, I think you have the pole position on the more interesting, at least overarching stories when it comes to history and stuff. So I guess I'll start with Wade. What's life going to be like without Dwayne Wade? I'll leave it open to you on that one because that can go in a number of different directions.
Yeah, that's going to be tough to predict exactly because I think obviously there's going to be some loyalty issues there. I think, you know, Wade was the face of the franchise for 13 seasons. He was such a part of helping maintain that winning culture that had been there throughout the whole Pat Riley era. And obviously the five trips to the NBA Finals, three championships, et cetera. All the personal individual accolades, those kinds of things. You know, he'd been such a special part of the team moving forward. In the past. But the reality is that he had taken a step back there. So I think looking at the personnel that's currently on the team, it might not be much of a stretch to say that the team is actually better off without Wade there. And I know that sounds kind of a shock and maybe a little heartless, but that's just strictly speaking as to the product that gets put out on the floor. I think, you know, Goran Dragic, Justice Winslow, Josh Richardson, Hassan Whiteside, those kind of players play better at a faster pace. And unfortunately, Wade was, you know, the facilitator for most of his career. He took a step back during the Big Three era, kind of let LeBron James take over. But the reality is that he kind of slowed the pace down considerably. He thrived more in what he called the old man game. And now that he's gone, the personnel that's left is probably better suited for a faster paced, up-tempo style of play. So I'm expecting better things out of this Miami team.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting sort of crossover thing that the Hawks have too in changing their playing style. But with Wade, being out of there, obviously, you know, the gut reaction is to say that the team's going to be much worse because Dwayne Wade is, you know, one of the, you know, 30 best players of all time. I mean, sure. He's obviously a phenomenal player, and, you know, but he's, at the same time, he's not the same, not quite the same player that he was during his prime, and the rest of the pieces don't really fit in the same way. I think that, you think that's part of the reason why Miami was sort of willing to let him hit the market in the way that they did? Obviously, Pat Riley and Wade had that sort of famous struggle back and forth, but it didn't really feel real as an outsider until it actually happened. So is that one of the reasons that you think that Riley let Wade sort of get away, is that they kind of wanted to secretly move on without him?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Riley's established a pretty well-earned reputation of being kind of cold and being a masterful planner. You know, he's always looking five steps ahead of everybody else. And you could probably say that that's been the case, that he was kind of nudging Wade out the door for a few seasons. Now, they went through similar contract negotiations last year, and at the, you know, 11th hour, Wade was able to secure a one-year $20 million deal, and, you know, that brought it to the same situation this time. And unfortunately, it just seems like they couldn't come to an agreement. I think most fans expected Wade to take less because he has in the past, but clearly that wasn't his priority. He wanted to make a little money and get some kind of, I guess, security or maybe a little bit more recognition, appreciation from the team, I guess. And that's kind of what, you know, burned the last bridge between Riley and Wade.
Yeah, and I talked a little bit about the – I did a quick preview of each Southeast team a couple of weeks ago on my show. And, you know, in talking about Miami, I think I basically said that the one team that I actually could have seen Wade leaving for was Chicago. Some of the stuff with, you know, Denver kind of being in the mix at one point, wasn't Milwaukee supposed to be getting a meeting with Dwayne? None of that stuff ever felt real to me, but Chicago certainly, I guess, you know, now that it happened, definitely feels real, but at least that being his hometown and stuff, it made a little bit more sense, almost in the same way that, you know, I think Dwight Howard coming to Atlanta is probably only something that actually happened because he's actually from here.
Right. Is that, you know, in your opinion, is that something that's been blown up a little bit? I mean, has there been interest from Howard in the past and quote unquote returning home and returning to Atlanta? Because it doesn't, I mean, not to my knowledge, I've never really associated Howard with the Atlanta area. But I mean, if he's made those kind of statements in the past, or I know that's certainly part of, you know, his media appearances since he signed with Atlanta. But did you get that feeling that there was a yearning on his part to return home?
Yeah, a little bit. He was asked directly about it. I think it's been a few weeks now. It was kind of, I think it was at an introductory press conference, but he was asked sort of about it. He didn't go over the top to say that that was a huge part of him coming home. And you know, he didn't really have the opportunity in the past to sign a big free agent deal here. The Stars didn't really align in that way. But I'm kind of with you. You know, I grew up here. I actually played against Dwight in high school. We're the exact same age and class. So not that I'm on the level of Dwight, but I was. I sort of watched him go and grow around Atlanta. So I've always associated him with that. But at the same time, nationally, I don't think his brand is associated with Atlanta, even in the way that Wade's was with Chicago. Even though, you know, Wade's obviously closely associated with Miami, it was pretty common knowledge, I think, that Wade was from Chicago. Yeah. So if he ever left Miami, that would probably be the place that he ended up. Whereas Howard, I think people, you know, diehard people know that he's from Atlanta, but I'm not sure that the Stars were ever going to be aligned super well to have him come home. But the way that it happened, where I think it's a good landing spot for Dwight, in that, you know, being from here probably lessens expectations just a little bit on Howard. He can sort of operate as the big man on campus, and the fact that he's the most famous player on the roster. But at the same time, the pressures here are not nearly the same way as they were, especially in Los Angeles, but even in Houston. I think Houston's much more of an NBA town than Atlanta is right now. And because he's the first, you know, quote-unquote superstar name that's been on the Hawks roster in quite some time, that's going to give him a little bit more of a grace period than I think he would have had going to a couple of other places. Even if he's not really the superstar player anymore, he's certainly as famous as a superstar player, which sure helps in that, you know, a lot of the fan base in Atlanta has always been starved for a superstar player, even though I think personally that Howard is not as good as Al Horford is. He's a lot more famous, and that certainly will play well with a large segment of the fan base that wants that that sort of extra attention that the Hawks don't ever really seem to get.
Now, you bring up a good point there about you know, the fans and their expectations. I mean, being from Miami, you hear a lot of negativity about the Miami Heat fan base, that there aren't many. And of course, there was that video from the playoffs a few years ago when they left too early, only to, you know, miss out on a game-saving three-pointer by Ray Allen in Game 6 of the NBA Finals, etc. But you know, what's the fan situation like for Hawks fans? I know there's been some criticism there about attendance in the past, and you know, the talks I think about moving the stadium and things of that sort. But are they going to be drawn to the bigger name of a guy like, you know, Howard, or as opposed to the quality play that we saw from a couple seasons where they won 60 plus games?
It's an interesting split. I think a lot of the fan base feels the way that I do, and that they weren't super thrilled with this move because it felt like PR to a certain extent, and really felt like a change in a way that I didn't really love for the organization to take. But at the same time, you know, the team has been steadfast in that it's not a PR move. And, you know, there is the issue with the fan base. It's not a massive fan base. I'm on record as saying I think Atlanta is a basketball town, an NBA town, just not a Hawks town. If you look at, like, look at TV ratings, Atlanta's routinely in the top 10 markets in the country when it comes to the NBA. But that just, for some reason, has never crossed over to the Hawks. It's more of a star-driven entity, which is one argument for going out and getting Howard, is that Howard is at least famous enough to where he might be able to drive some extra traffic down there. You know, 2 years ago when the Hawks won 70 games, that place was rocking for about 2-3 months down the stretch, and they were selling out games, and it was actually, you know, for somebody like me who grew up here, it was kind of odd to see because you never really see the Hawks sell out games unless it's against a big-time opponent, like when LeBron's in town or when the Lakers were in town with Kobe, then they certainly sell out some games. But for a regular game against Milwaukee in January, the Hawks don't always sell tickets very well. So I think they might get a little bit of a bump from Dwight. But I think if that's their goal, it's going to be a short-sighted one. And you know, for as popular as Dwight is, and for as good as he still is at basketball, it's not quite the same as getting a legitimate top 10 superstar that might have individually sort of started to pack the building more often than not. I think Dwight might get a little bit of a bump early on, but the fan base is still going to be fickle in that the team's going to have to win enough for Atlanta. Atlanta's full of transplants. It's one of the knocks on it as a sports city, is that, you know, a lot of sports fans live here and have their own teams outside of Atlanta. So they're going to have a hard time filling the building, I think, again this year, unless the team is better than I think it's going to be. But I do think, you know, some of the stuff's overblown, and that Atlanta fans get picked on more so than a lot of other cities. But some of it's definitely, you know, justifiable. As someone who lived here and was a diehard fan, it drives me nuts, and I'll rant on occasion about how bad the fans are, how they don't arrive on time, et cetera, et cetera. So stuff drives me crazy too, and you know, some of it's earned, but I think not as much of it is earned as people want to attribute to Atlanta from the outside.
I'm curious because, you know, I know that you've been a little critical of the offseason moves. I guess you didn't feel that this was the right way to go. I know that there are a section of the fan base that thought that, you know, with Horford's departure, it might have been better just to simply, quote unquote, tank and maybe move forward to a new younger type team rather than going out and getting a bigger name and an expensive one at that in Dwight Howard. But, you know, there's some optimism right there. I think there could be some reason for optimism considering, you know, you've got, you know, Coach Bud in place there. And I mean, considering his past with the San Antonio Spurs and the fact that he's worked with two prominent low post players and, you know, David Robinson and Tim Duncan, isn't there some hope that even though this is a completely different style of play than what we've seen in the past, that maybe he can, you know, make the most of Dwight Howard's presence there and maximize his talent on the floor?
Absolutely. I think I'm more positive on it than I would have been if Budenholzer wasn't around. If the Hawks had, you know, an average coach, just pick a random guy in your head that's an NBA coach that's not an impressive guy, not a bad coach, but just a
Randy Whitman.
Sure, Randy Whitman. I think he might be below average, but yeah, we'll go with Randy Whitman. That's fine. If he was the coach of this team, I'd be terrified. Okay. It's not as if they would be awful by any means, but I wouldn't have any sort of the trust factor that I have with Budenholzer. You said that I've been critical. That's definitely true. I've caught some flack for being negative about the moves. In truth, it's really just the one move. I like the draft that the Hawks did. We could talk about that if you want to. I like that. I like the Jeff Teague trade. I like the Malcolm Delaney sign. There's stuff that I like the Hawks did. I just did not love the way they handled the Horford Howard situation. I'm with the segment of the fan base. I get it, that people that wanted to blow it up. I'm on that side as well. If you let Horford go, I would have probably just blown it up. But at the same time, going back to the fan discussion we had a second ago, this is not a market that's really set up very well to blow it up. They won't be able to sell tickets in this market if they're bad. We saw that, you know, before this most recent era, the last 10 years or so, the Hawks have been pretty darn good. You know, never elite, but certainly good and solid in a playoff team. They had the longest current playoff streak in the Eastern Conference, which people don't really know. I think it's 9 or 10 years in a row now. Before that, the team was awful, and they couldn't sell tickets. And I understood, I understand now with a new ownership group that they don't want to go back there. And you know, when the head coach is also the director of basketball operations, you know, those guys don't usually want to blow it up because they have to coach this team.
Right.
So it wasn't ever going to be a situation that I think was going to ever happen. So with that in mind, you know, they could have done worse than signing Howard. I think Howard's going to be solid. And I do trust Budenholzer to mold him in the best possible way as long as Dwight buys in. That's sort of the elephant in the room, is that his reputation around the league is not the best in terms of just fitting in and kind of doing his job. I think coming home will keep him on his best behavior. And, you know, Dwight's 30 now, so I think he might be maturing just a little bit. But last year in Houston was kind of a disaster. So my guard is up, I'll say that, on Howard. But I do trust it more with Bud around. And I think you probably feel the same way about Spoelstra. Just having that upper echelon coach allows you to just have that trust factor that you wouldn't normally have with a run-of-the-mill guys like Randy Whitman or somebody of that ilk.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, Spoelstra – He's been able to guide. Everybody assumes that he's, you know, had this kind of success because of the Big Three era and everything else, but they often forget that he coached a team for two seasons prior to that and was able to take a fairly mediocre Heat group into the playoffs both times. I think they even met the Hawks at one of those occasions as well. But actually in 2009, if I'm not mistaken, they met the Hawks. And actually, I'll never forget that because Jermaine O'Neal couldn't even live up to his pitiful points per game average that season, and if he had just scored. It was that series where they kept going back and forth, where there were continuous blowouts on either side.
Yeah, it was an awful series.
It really was. And if O'Neal had just managed to score, you know, 8 points per game or whatever it was, they probably would have been able to get past Atlanta. But that's a whole different story. Anyway, with Spoelstra there, I think, you know, he's got a good pulse of this team. He's really taken some major steps as far as developing younger players. We saw that with Hassan Whiteside. We saw that with Tyler Johnson. These are guys that have gone up through the D-League system, and they found success here at the professional level with Miami. And you know, you have to look at Josh Richardson, a guy who was a second-round pick and maybe not expected to make much of an impact, but Spoelstra kind of worked with him very closely, helping him develop his perimeter shooting in particular. And it was really, you know, we saw that evidence late last season when he really, I mean, he was on fire. He shot almost 50% from three-point range. It was ridiculous. And, you know, obviously that's not sustainable, although I'd like to think it is. But we've seen Spoelstra be able to mentor these younger players. And so now with this new era there, and without, you know, unless Chris Bosh is available every single game, we're not going to have like a clear-cut leader on the floor. And I think this is a really great opportunity for Spoelstra to continue to establish himself and help guide this team to this era, because it's going to be a difficult one, I think. I mean, there's going to be moments there where there's going to be some really great action on the floor, but it's also going to be a transitional period. You can't help that. I mean, it's one that's made easier, again, if Bosh is available. And that's, you know, you asked about that earlier. And you know, who knows what's going to happen with Chris Bosh, because right now it seems like he's ready to play. He wants to play. But at the same time, there's been a lack of communication from the front office, from the coaching staff. And that's an issue of concern for a lot of Heat fans, I think. But as far as Spoelstra is concerned, I think, yeah, I think the team is in very good hands there, and maybe a little underrated hands, I think, because a lot of people tend to, you know, minimize his accomplishments because of the talent that he's had. But all good coaches need great talent as well.
I've been a big defender of Spoelstra, you know, really the whole time throughout, you know, pre-LeBron era, during LeBron era, and post-LeBron era. He's been, I think he's one of the top 10 coaches in the league pretty solidly. So, you know, so with that, I think if you asked a random NBA fan that same question, I'm not sure they would include him there. I made the same point on a recent podcast about Charlotte and Steve Clifford, another guy. And this, right. I think this division's sort of loaded with these guys. Frank Vogel's a good coach as well in Orlando.
Absolutely.
Budenholzer. So, you know, for even if you don't like Scott Brooks, he's certainly an upgrade on Randy Whitman, I think.
Yeah.
So a bunch of solid coaches in the division. But back to Bosh, I do want to ask you, obviously you don't know anything that most people wouldn't know about Bosh's right. health situation. But right. I think it's pretty interesting just to think about Miami both ways. If Bosh is able to play, play, you know, 70 games, or if he's just completely gone. I think, you know, that's obviously a huge spectrum in terms of this team, considering, you know, if he's not the best player on the team, he's certainly one of the best players, and he's easily the most established player. You kind of know what you're going to get from Bosch as a, I think, a future Hall of Famer. So, you know, Bosch is an excellent player if he's on the court. You know, what's the team supposed to look like in your mind if he's unavailable? Is that still a team that can make the playoffs? And if he is available, what kind of ceiling are we looking at with Miami?
And to go back to your point, he's clearly the best player on the team just because of his versatility and everything else. And you know as well as I do that he might not have been appreciated as much during the Big Three era, but he was just as vital a part there as of LeBron towards that, you know, era success. So, I mean, clearly Bosch is still the best player. But
I'm with you on that one, by the way.
Yeah, I thought so. As far as what the team would look like without Bosch, that's tough to say, but I would expect, you know, they brought in a lot of veterans on short-term contracts there, one of which was Derek Williams. I think he's liable to start if Bosch isn't available. Now, there's also the option of sliding Justice Winslow from the small forward position where he's more of a natural fit to power forward. He's played center at some point, as he did during the playoffs last year against Toronto. I don't think that's ideal for him. But at the same, he could play the power forward position if he needed to. I think he'll probably stay at small forward. I think Derek Williams would start at power forward. When things seemed less optimistic just a month ago, you know, we predicted that Derek Williams would be the starter on opening day. Who knows? At this point, it seems like Bosch might have the clearance that he needs in order to be the starter. But let's say Bosch isn't in the lineup. Derek Williams comes out there. He's looking at his stint in Miami as an opportunity for him to parlay that into a bigger contract. You know, he hasn't had much success throughout his short career, but he's looked at Miami's track record of revitalizing careers and taking, you know, reclamation projects like Hassan Whiteside or Chris Anderson and others, and hopefully he'll be able to continue developing somewhat here in Miami. He could provide a little outside shooting, a little athleticism, and again, with Dragic in control now, he's probably a player who would thrive a little bit more in an open court, fast-paced style, so that seems to be the case there. Now, if Derek Williams is starting, that changes a lot as far as what kind of lineups you roll out there, the rotation and everything else. I don't know if the team is necessarily as deep to compete for a playoff spot. So I would think that they would probably miss out on the playoffs without Chris Bosch there. Now, with him, that changes completely. Just because of his versatility, his ability to defend on the perimeter, assuming, again, that he's at full strength and he plays a majority of the Heat's regular season games, he adds so much. You know, his he can facilitate from the high post. He can shoot it from outside at a very high rate. His mid-range game, his ability to drive past, you know, slower centers or forwards. You know, you can use him as a center in smaller lineups if you want to take Whiteside out or if Whiteside gets into foul trouble. And he just adds so much more of a greater dimension to what Spoelstra can create as far as these lineups and rotations are concerned. So with him, I think the ceiling obviously gets much higher, and I would predict him to probably win, I would say, maybe mid to high 40s, you know, let's say 49 at most, and probably somewhere around 45 at the low end, and probably could be able to compete along with all those other teams for like the 7th or 8th spot in the Eastern Conference playoff race.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to talk about Miami, obviously, because of that Bosch stuff. Being that it's cloaked in so much uncertainty from everyone. I mean, even guys who are, you know, super plugged in. I listen to national podcasts with guys like Brian Windhorst, who has been super plugged in with Bosch and probably, you know, has sources, and nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody knows anything about Bosch's situation.
It's been bizarre, to be honest with you. It's really weird.
Yeah, it's very from an outsider's perspective, it's very odd. So I can't imagine trying to cover the team like you do every day and just not knowing anything about it.
Right. I mean, they've been so secretive. And, you know, Riley's come, I think, somewhat deservedly under fire for, you know, his lack of communication with Wade and the way he kind of nudged him out. You know, the fact that he may or may not have pushed LeBron out the door as well. I mean, he's challenged players. It's definitely an old school blue collar type of mentality. A lot of people tend to associate Riley with, you know, Los Angeles and the Showtime era. But you tend to forget that he comes from a small town in New York called Schenectady, and he's more of a blue-collar type guy, and I think that's his roots at heart. That's why he built those defensive-minded teams with the Knicks and then again here in Miami when he first came on board in 1995. So I think he's pushed players, and it hasn't always worked. And I think we're starting to see some of that kind of bite him in the ass a little bit, to be honest with you. And I'm concerned for whether or not Bosch feel some kind of pressure there, and whether or not he feels like there might be a contentious relationship in place. Because if you listen to his recent comments on the Uninterrupted podcast, you know, he says he's going to be playing in the NBA regardless, but then follows that up by saying, well, I don't have clearance from the team, but I'm going to be playing anyway. And that speaks to me that, you know, he's going to bring this up as a potentially legal issue. Then maybe he could bring it up with the Players Association, maybe try and force a way off the team. Who knows what could happen? So there's definitely some issues at play here.
Yeah, between all that stuff and, you know, just not knowing what he, like, if saying that he wants to play in that way, you know, talking about the contract stuff, he makes a lot of money and that Miami might not want to be paying him, it seems like. Yeah. So there's that whole extra wrinkle of that, you know, how much does that have to do with this? And if Bosch was making $5 million a year versus $25 million, would it be different?
Oh, absolutely.
it's all this extra stuff. So I don't envy you in some ways, and I also do envy you in that you have some content to talk about in a way that most teams don't. But at the same time, I do want to ask you about one other thing for sure, and that is Hassan Whiteside.
Okay.
Before he signed to stay in Miami, there was a lot of Hawks fans who were interested at least thinking about exploring the possibility of Whiteside if Horford were to move on, and he obviously did. By the time that all happened, Whiteside was basically off the market anyway, but a lot of Hawks fans were asking me before I even started doing this podcast, when I was still just writing, and we get questions about Whiteside. Are you super happy with Miami's investment in him, you know, with that max contract? Is that something you feel comfortable with? Is it too much of a risk for you given his, you know, the age, the way that he was a late bloomer and sort of the off-court uncertainty with him? Or are you happy about the deal in general and just encouraged about his prospects?
You know, that's a tough one to answer because I expect him to continue to develop somewhat. And, you know, he's already shown a lot of potential and great ability, but I think there's another level for him. And I think you know, part of that is his ability to continue to grow as an offensive playmaker. You know, his passing obviously is his biggest weakness, but there's more room for him to grow from an offensive standpoint as far as developing, you know, better low post moves, working more on a hook shot and things of that sort. You know, he's much more of a rim roller, a guy who can catch it if you just toss it up because of his incredible length and his athleticism. You know, he's a hell of a leaper. He can catch that lob and finish from a pretty far distance there, but he needs to be a little bit more polished, a little bit more active, even perhaps as a rebounder. You know, we saw him lose the rebounding battle to Jonas Valanciunas against the Raptors. And then even prior to that, Al Jefferson seemed to be able to get his number on occasions. And you know, Jefferson's never been known as a real aggressive rebounder. But, you know, I think the re-signing of Whiteside is a good move. But at the same time, I think it's a little bit too expensive. And I would have hoped that they could have brought him back at a more cap friendly deal. Excuse me.
No, I get it. It's one of those things where I think I had the same thought about Horford at the same time. I would have actually been okay giving him the 5-year max, but I wouldn't have loved it by any stretch. I would have preferred that to what the Hawks ended up doing. But with Whiteside, I don't think you can let that asset get away with all of what Miami did to really raise him up and really invest in him already, kind of grabbing off the scrap heap. Whiteside was a guy I really actually liked in the draft long ago before he started, you know, toiling in obscurity for a few years. But now that he's sort of capitalizing on all of that talent that he has, it would have been rough, I think, for the Heat to let him go. But at the same time, I'm with you that it's probably an overpay. That's kind of what you had to do to keep him, and I think he would have gotten that deal somewhere else had the Heat not offered it. At least the max deal, you know, with a dollar here different, wherever else he would have gotten, I'm sure he would have gotten paid heavily somewhere else. So it's always that opportunity cost of whether you want to overpay slightly for a guy or let him go. The Hawks chose to let their guy go, and Miami chose to sign their guy.
Well, I've got a quick question for you now that you bring up Whiteside, because I think he might be the X factor for the team, aside from Bosch being a more obvious one. But as far as if you know, Whiteside and what steps he takes as far as his continued development. But I think I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up a question that my co-host Wes Goldberg wanted me to ask about Dennis Schroeder.
Bring it on, Wes.
Do you consider him to be the team's X factor, or is there something else there that you think might hinder the Hawks' development next season? Because I think there's a reputation there about Schroeder, whether or not is he able at this point to lead this team, to be the guy that replaced Jeff Teague? Can he help guide this new incarnation of the Hawks moving forward?
you know, if you ask me to pick one X factor, it probably would be Dennis. There, it's either him or Dwight Howard, obviously, because you know Dwight is it's all the fit concerns we've already talked about. But with all that aside, I think Schroeder is certainly an X factor, if not the biggest one. He's sort of the only young asset on this team outside of the two rookies that the team has drafted, in Torian Prince and DeAndre Bembry. Schroeder's the one guy who is still super young. He's only 23 years old, and he's sort of has the upside. Actually, he just turned 23. I think his birthday is either today or yesterday. So he just turned 23. This will be his first time as a starter. I'm not in love with Schroeder's game in the same way that a lot of Hawks fans are. I do like him in that his upside is pretty high. He's super athletic, very long, physically gifted guy who can really defend already when he's locked in. Not always the most attentive guy in the world, but I do like his defense and his overall attributes. What I worry about is his lack of efficiency.
Right.
He was not very efficient at all over the last couple seasons as a backup, and I can't imagine that's going to get any better as a starter, especially in year one as being a starter, when he's suddenly playing low 30s in minutes versus 20 minutes a game or so, backing up Jeff Teague. Schroeder's a guy who's going to fill the stat sheet. He's going to get points and assists. He's going to lead the team in usage by a comfortable margin. He led the team last year in usage rate. Obviously, was playing less minutes, but I think almost everything offensively is going to run through Schroeder at some point, which is a scary thought for me. I think this team could be pretty bad offensively on a per possession basis because of that. Between that and Howard, and the way that the space is going to be really a big challenge for the Hawks this year, with those two guys replacing two guys in Teague and Horford that were much better shooters and better ball movers. I like Schroeder. It's just it's the fact that I'm a bit scared of him, of the Hawks really investing too much in him. I'm hoping that they let him get to this season without doing an extension. I want to see Schroeder prove it this year as a full-time starter, even with the upside that he does have. I was interested to see, Sports Illustrated left him out of their top 100 altogether this week. It was something I talked about on the podcast, but he was behind a bunch of guys that were pretty surprising. I think that's a good indication of what the national perception is versus the local perception. A lot of Hawks fans are just sold on Dennis. I get questions about him being an all-star this year, which is pretty aggressive, I would say. But I like Dennis. He's definitely the X factor of this team. He's got to be able to be a better shooter, I would say, if there's one thing he absolutely has to do, aside from just improving his efficiency and cutting out on turnovers, is that he has to shoot the ball better. And I'm just not convinced that he's ever going to be more than a low to mid-30s at the best three-point shooter, and that's just going to kind of cap his ceiling. So I think he's the X factor. I'm just not sure that's the best thing in the world as far as this team really growing beyond a mid-tier Eastern Conference playoff team.
Well, that's interesting. And I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, we talked about Bosch, and he's obviously a big concern and his contract and everything else, but you've got your own issues there with Paul Millsap and his impending contract issues. Now, I think I read that you expect Millsap to re-sign with the team, or to not, maybe you mentioned it in a podcast, that you expect him to actually not pick up his player option this year and stick around. He's got 2 years left with a player option at the end of the season. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would actually be shocked if he picked it up, to be honest, because unless he has a bad season or if he gets injured, Paul, I think is a pretty consensus top 20 player in the league right now. For as much as he's super underrated for casual fans, I think people that do this for a living, people like us that are like super diehards, just can really appreciate what Paul does on the court. He just does everything well, great defender, but he'll be 32 at the end of this year. I think this would be his last opportunity to really get paid. And for as much as it's a lot of money that he'd be leaving on the table to decline the option. He'll only be doing that because he's going to get a lot more money than that on the open market. Being 32, I don't think he wants to leave another year up to chance. I'd be pretty surprised, especially because, the Hawks sort of famously drug him around trade rumors a little bit.
Yeah.
In the midst of the Howard Horford swap, there was a brief moment where it looked like the Hawks were going to sign Horford and Howard and then trade Millsap and then play out power forward. And during that little brief afternoon in time, Millsap was heavily involved in trade rumors, and he didn't appreciate that. I think it was Chris Villanmore of the AJC interviewed him. And, Paul's super professional. He's not going to just kill the organization, but it was pretty clear to me that he was not pleased about that. And any extra goodwill that he probably had toward the Hawks in a way that might give them a discount is probably gone now.
Yeah.
He's going to play hard because that's just the kind of guy he is. He's not going to be a problem off the court or on the court, but I don't think he's going to be taking a hometown discount now, especially in that his first contract with the Hawks was a super discount when Danny Ferry just stole him from Utah for 2 years and $19 million total.
That's right.
Right now he's on a max deal, essentially, so he's properly paid at this moment, but the next deal is not going to be a favorable one, I don't think. As for much as I like Paul, I think he's gonna age well compared to most guys in his position because he's not super reliant on athleticism and stuff like that. But,
right.
You know, at 32, the decline's going to happen unless you're an athletic freak like LeBron or somebody like that. It's going to happen. He's going to decline here. Won't be a superstar-level player like he is now. So I don't think the Hawks want to necessarily pay him a four-year max deal. So I think it's going to be interesting. He's going to hit the market. Maybe the Hawks will want to keep him around, but you're also limiting yourself a lot in that you're already paying Howard $20-something million, and if you lock up Millsap on what it's going to cost, which is probably like $30 million a year,
yeah.
Which is a lot of money. You're talking about paying $50-55 million a year for two guys who are in their 30s in the front court, and that is probably not a recipe to construct a championship contender. So a big decision coming for both Millsap and the Hawks. I just think that it would be pretty surprising if Millsap didn't at least explore the free agent market after this year.
How do you anticipate him being able to work alongside Dwight Howard? Because I guess that's the bigger concern for a lot of people looking at this team. You know, it works a lot better when you have a guy like Horford who can shoot from outside and is such a good passer, et cetera. But I don't think Howard is quite up to that level as far as his passing, and he's certainly not when it comes to his shooting. You know, do you think that Millsap's numbers take a dive this year? Do you think he's going to struggle a little bit? Do you think he's just, going to be able to put up his own numbers and not necessarily worry about Dwight and his effectiveness overall?
It's pretty interesting on both ends of the court. I think his numbers are going to dip a little bit. Some of that is that, you know, Millsap basically had his career year last year and stuff in the stat sheet. So it's almost like he's due for a little bit of a drop off regardless. Mm-hmm. Even if Horford was back, I'd probably say the same thing. On one hand, I'll be positive now because I get killed for being negative. I'll be positive in saying that Howard's rebounding and his rim protection should help Millsap. That was the one knock on Horford that I had and really anybody had is that he's not a very good defensive rebounder for a center. Mm-hmm. And Millsap was having to kind of kill himself and to gain rebound alongside Horford. Now with Howard, that's the one thing you know he's going to be very good at is defensive rebounding. That'll take a little bit of pressure off Paul to kind of give him a little bit more time to not relax but not go 100% all the time on the defensive glass. You know, the spacing stuff is very real offensively. Millsap's jump shooting is solid, but not elite at all. And having Howard and Schroeder, honestly, on the court together is going to hurt spacing overall, which could probably attract more attention to Paul offensively, which is not great. Defensively, I'm not worried per se, but the Hawks are going to have to change a lot of stuff. This is where I trust Budenholzer, like we talked about earlier. They're going to have to change a lot of what they do. Last year, they sort of turned themselves into this, like, trapping ball-hawking defense, and it really worked very well for them. But a lot of that was predicated on having two bigs in Horford and Millsap that could really fly around and switch a lot. Howard's not that guy anymore. In his prime, he was, you know, perhaps the best athlete in the league at center. That's no longer the case. He's still good at defense, but not in the same way where he's going to be flat out to switch on guard. So the Hawks are going to have to change their schemes a little bit. Millsap was an all-defensive team player last year, and a lot of that was because he stuffed the stat sheet with steals and blocks, but it was also because the Hawks were so good defensively. So that fit's going to be interesting. It's going to be a change. I think defense I'm not really worried about, but the offense is troublesome to me in that it's just an overall thing more so than it is with just Millsap, but the lack of spacing is going to hurt, I think, everyone, and it will definitely hurt Paul, and that he'll be probably getting more attention than he was getting last year on an individual basis. And nobody, you know, as good as he is, nobody's going to be quite as good if they're getting, extending an extra foot on the defense and taking less open shots.
Well, I think you've answered that pretty quickly. You got anything else for me on my end about the Heat this season?
I did want to ask you before I have to get a prediction from you. Knowing the Bosch stuff, it'll be very hard. But I do want to, before I ask that question, talk to me about Tyler Johnson. I love Tyler Johnson, but the contract is a very, very weird. When I tried to explain it on my podcast about the Arenas rule stuff and all of that, but 4 years, $50 million for Tyler Johnson, I'm sure surprised everyone nationally. I like him a lot, but what can we expect from Johnson? Is he going to live up to that contract? Are you a fan of the deal? Because it was obviously a match of a restricted free agency contract. So it's very it's an odd dynamic with him and Richardson and Dragic in the backcourt. It's a lot of bodies there, but it's a lot of guys that I like too.
And you forgot Deion Waiters, who wasn't, you know, expected to be there available.
That was on purpose, by the way. I'm not a Deion guy. Maybe you are, but I am not. But, you know, he is there. I should say that he's there.
You're talking to the wrong group here, because both Wes and I will spend a whole podcast talking about Deion Waiters. And we actually, before he even became a free agent, and we never thought he'd actually join Miami, but we started launching a movement called, you know, hashtag Waiters Peninsula, where we thought he actually could come down to Miami.
Listen, right. before I let you go, I love the Waiters signing for Miami because it was so cheap.
Sure.
I don't like Deion, but like that's a zero risk gamble that anybody probably should have taken. Even for somebody like me who basically hates Deion's game, it's so cheap that yeah, man, bring him in and see what happens.
He's just one of those guys that embodies chaos, and to me, that's a lot of fun, if nothing else. I mean, maybe some fans think of Schroeder being along the same way because of his lack of effectiveness overall. But I mean, I know there are just moments there where I'm kind of left in awe of what Deion can do, and I kind of appreciate it. And I've had the opportunity to cover him in person and see him in locker room situations, and he's a really interesting person. Let's leave it at that. So I think he's a lot of fun to cover, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Miami does with him this season. But as far as Tyler is concerned, you know, a couple weeks ago, I think we would have predicted that Josh Richardson would be the starter and that Tyler is probably best suited as a sixth man. But now Josh Richardson suffered his MCL strain and he'll be out for 6 to 8 weeks. So he's probably going to miss the start of the season. And so that probably means that Deion Waiters will wind up starting. So I think we'll see him as a starter for most of the preseason and probably the first, you know, few weeks of the regular season. And that Tyler Johnson will probably stay as the sixth man coming off the bench. Now, obviously the contract is a problem, at least in years 3 and 4 of the deal. And that's assuming that he's even part of Miami's roster. So I think, you know, you kind of have to temper it a little bit in that you'll probably get really good value for him in years 1 and 2. And then whatever happens in year 3, well, maybe Riley can move him. Maybe he, you know, he'll grow into that contract and be much more productive than we anticipate at this point. But you know, that's an issue to deal with a couple years down the road. And I think everybody's just more focused on having him develop and continuing to grow. And we've seen some promise from him. You know, you said you were a big fan of his. You know, as a defender, he puts a lot of effort there. He's very athletic and explosive. He can dive to the rim. He can dunk with ease. You know, he's a heck of a good 3-point shooter as well. He's not quite the facilitator or ball handler that you'd want. And that's a problem for a player of his size, because I think he's listed at 6'4", and that is not the case. You know, he's probably a couple inches shorter than that. But he makes up for with some incredible athleticism, but the ball handling just isn't there at this point. So that might be the next step for him, and that's probably why he'll come in off the bench as a combo guard. If Richardson had started, I would have expected him to slide to the point guard with, you know, Tyler Johnson coming in and playing a little two guard. Because even in lineups last year where Tyler did play, Wade was still handling the ball most of the time, and Tyler would kind of play off of that. And that's, you know, to his advantage, because he can, you know, cut past players, he can roam around a lot, and his athleticism makes up for that lack of ball handling. So, you know, it's tough to predict exactly, you know, what his ceiling is going to be, because I think, you know, another issue for me personally is the fact that he is a little undersized and he's already had to deal with a number of injury issues throughout his short career. You know, we're talking about a player 2 years out of college and he can't seem to stay on for a prolonged period of time. And I think a lot of that has to do with the size, the fact that he is, you know, willing to throw his body around as much as it does. You know, he's going to get hurt. And I think that's a concern moving forward, that whether or not he's even healthy enough to live up to years 3 and 4 of his contract.
Yeah, and, you know, all credit to Pat Riley for unearthing Johnson and Richardson, who are both guys who were sort of diamonds in the rough that they pulled out of nowhere. I felt bad for Richardson on the injury, but it looks like it's not terribly serious, right? So he'll be back, but, you know, near the start of the regular season, something like that?
Yeah, 6 to 8 weeks, more or less. So, yeah, he'll probably be miss the first week or two, I think, of the regular season.
Yeah, and he's a guy I like as well. So that's I don't love the whole roster construction in Miami, to be honest with you. But those two guys were good diamonds in the rough that Pat Riley unearthed. So okay, before I let you go, I have to get you. I'll get your Miami thoughts too. But I want you to try to peg the division in order. This is something that I've been really struggling with, trying to figure out the order of finish in the Southeast Division, because I think the top four are pretty much clear of the fifth team, but I have no idea what order to put them in. So give me your Miami prediction, and also, if you can, at least try to attempt to put the Southeast in order, because it's something that I cannot figure out how to do right now.
Yeah, I don't know that I can either, to be honest with you. And I think a lot of people have Orlando a lot lower rated than they might actually be. You know, they might actually wind up putting over, putting together that mishmash of talent in a way that works for them. Because, you know, I give a lot of credit to Vogel. You talked about him earlier, and I think he's capable of getting that team, to a winning situation, if not necessarily into the postseason. But try to rank this. Wow, that's a tough one.
That's what happens to me too.
Yeah, I would have to say that Atlanta probably is the division leader at this point. I think if Bosch is healthy and near the level where he's been during the past few seasons when he has played, I think Miami might actually be the second best team in the conference. I mean, the division, rather. Followed up by Charlotte, Washington, and then Orlando, I guess, would be the fifth best team in the division.
Yeah, Orlando, I think, is clearly five. But you're right. I do like Vogel and some of that talent, especially if a guy like Hezonja sort of breaks out in year two. He's sort of an X-factor guy. I love that Evan Fournier contract, for instance.
Orlando, it's Aaron Gordon, I think. Aaron Gordon in particular.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he's going to be pushed into the small forward position now with Ibaka and Vucevic and Bismack Biyombo and all these players that they got there. So Gordon has to be more of a facilitator, a playmaker, kind of the role that Justice Winslow has to take on in Miami now that Wade's gone. So I think that's a big challenge for Orlando and for Miami, obviously.
Yeah, so I think Orlando's solidly fifth, but I might pick, honestly, if you told me Bosch played 70 games, I think I'd pick Miami to win the division. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're talking about the blood thinners that'll be in his system, you know, that he'll take them at such a point in the daily schedule where they'll be out of his system by the time game time comes around. So it's going to be tricky. I mean, he alluded that, you know, there are players in other sports that take blood thinners and it's not a concern. I think there's the issue of whether or not he gets a lot of contact, whether or not he develops, you know, kind of a extensive bruising that might lead to blood clots. But there's also the fact that he, you know, apparently does not have whatever gene is necessary for this to be a recurring problem. But then you look at it, it's like, well, it's already happened twice in 2 years. How much more recurring does it need to be for it to be a major problem? So there's just so many issues at play here. I mean, I personally thought when the diagnosis came again last year, or last season rather, I thought, you know, that's it, he's done. And I thought he was going to retire, especially for a guy like him who has so many diverse interests off the floor and a family, you know, a growing family. He had twins and he's got, I think, five kids at this point. And you should, you know, you see him traveling all over the world. You would think that if anybody's capable of moving away from the game, it would be him. But apparently he just wants to keep coming back. He says the allure of that camaraderie of being able to compete at a high level keeps bringing him back. And that's why he wants to keep playing.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. It's definitely interesting to follow. But I'll say for me, I'll actually go Charlotte to win the division.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm lower on the Hawks than most people are. I think the offense is going to be rough. I'll say that I think the Hawks have the highest ceiling. Well, Miami with Bosch has the highest ceiling. But aside from that, I'm going to assume Bosch is not going to be there all year. He might be there part of the year. So with that in mind, I'll say that Hawks have the highest ceiling if everything goes right with Schroeder and Howard. I just don't – my offensive faith in the Hawks is not very good. So I think Charlotte's the safest team, to be honest with you. They may not be a 50-win club, but I think they're the safest to win in the mid-40s. If you had, but you're, you know, as much as I say this, I think I change my mind about every day on these four teams at the top, because that they're all kind of, I mean, they're not the same in the way that they're built, but they're all kind of the same in the way I think about them. They're all sort of teams that I think are going to win between, you know, 39 and 47 games, and you know, pick them out of the hat almost. Washington is the one that I talk about the least, but if you told me Beal plays all year and Wall's healthy, then they could certainly win 50 games. It wouldn't shock me. I think about 2 years, you know, before last season, Washington was a vogue pick to finish second in the East.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and they're really the same team, and they might even be better on paper than they were last year. So a lot of uncertainty. If you had to give me a Miami pick, what have you been using when people ask you? I'm sure the people ask you this question. Give me a win total that, you know, even if it's a range, something that I can peg so that I can get on you at the end of the year if things go wrong.
I think 40 to 43 games seems realistic.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. I think, and for the Hawks, I would go somewhere in that, really that same range. I've been getting yelled at about it, but I think it's somewhere in that same exact range, to be honest. And there's room above it, there's room below it, but in the safe range, it's somewhere in the low 40s. So I think we're on the same page. A lot of similarities between the two teams, or as much as uncertainty as there is on both sides, there's some similarities. It should be fun to watch, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Brad.
No problem at all. Hey, plug your stuff. Obviously, you are a host of the Locked On Heat podcast, but you can talk about that. Talk about anything else that you want to plug. Let's get it out there.
Yeah, you can follow us at Locked On Heat. Me and my co-host Wes Goldberg. You can follow me personally at DeverMill13 on Twitter. I write for Hardwood Paroxysm, Vice Sports, Today's Fast Break, and a couple other places along the way. So you can catch me in all my writing there. So if you have any questions, just let me know. And always come by Locked On Heat. You can always email us, review our podcast, just along with all the other great podcasts on the Locked On Podcast Network.
For sure, we'll have to do this again, especially as the Hawks and Heat will be playing four times this year. So I'm sure we'll have an occasion to speak again about these two teams. But follow the Locked On Heat podcast. Those guys do a great job. Follow Locked On Hawks podcast, selfishly for me, and PeachtreeHoops.com, where I write about the Hawks and really the whole network, man. We're doing there's an NFL show for basically any team that you like in football as well, and a basketball show if you are somehow a fan of another team and got onto this podcast. We thank you for listening, but there's a show for you as well. So go ahead and find that, and thanks again, David, for doing this, man. We'll have to do it again sometime.
You got it, Brad. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, guys. Stay tuned for both of our next shows.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.